Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my academic background at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Prakash Shah of the Department of Law at Queen Mary University of London in London, UK, on this fascinating publication called Western Foundations of the Caste System. Prakash, hello and welcome. It's a delight having you here.
Oh, hello, Raj. Thank you very much for your invitation, and it's a delight for me to be talking with you as well.
So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, maybe what you teach and all that?
Yes, my background, I suppose, for present purposes, you could say, is as an academic lawyer. I started really my research career as a scholar of migration law, and in particular, the law of refugees. But gradually, I also got interested in discussing and researching questions about ethnic minorities and law and cultural diversity and law. And so increasingly, I began to be interested in the question of religion. And in the meantime, I also developed a kind of interest in comparative, broader questions of comparative law. So looking at the laws of Asia, in particular South Asia. And I had studied under the now retired leading specialist of South Asian law, Werner Mensky, at the School of Oriental and African Studies, who also happened to be my PhD supervisor. So I, by osmosis, learned a lot from him about the specifics of the legal systems of South Asia, and also the implications of having a quite large South Asian diaspora, in particular, in the United Kingdom. So and so that was really my entry point into looking at questions of law in connection with South Asian groups in particular, which provides a kind of door to being interested in caste, which is what the book is about.
So perhaps maybe tell us, you make mention in your introduction, but tell us about the genesis then of the book.
Ah, well, the book actually also has a slightly different path or trajectory, because while I've been looking at questions of religion, and in particular religion and law, I became interested in the work of Professor S.N. Balagangadhara, who teaches at the University of Ghent in Belgium. And he has done some very fundamental and interesting work regarding the image of India in, let's say, the study of India, or this, you know, India studies, and how that has fundamentally been influenced by the image that Europeans have constructed about India. And in fact, we still largely appear to be within that framework or research paradigm, if you like, that much of what we think we know about India is really an inheritance of the production of let's say social sciences, but which has a backdrop of Orientalism, which itself has a backdrop of Christianity. So there are sort of basic constituent elements which have gone into the formulation of India as a subject of study, which depends on, let's say, in the very deep background, Christian presuppositions.
That's very much the case. So as our listeners may know, I am actually from the discipline of Hindu studies proper, in that my doctorate my discipline is religion, and my PhD work was in Hinduism proper. I studied mythologies of the Hindu goddess, and so much of really every crevice of the study of India is touched by Orientalist scholarly presuppositions and caricatures of India. And that's prevalent to this day, even among practitioners who have now a self-understanding of Hinduism, which was ultimately minted in colonial India.
Yes, and in connection more specifically with the book in question, we see that also affecting in a very basic way the study of caste. And the whole discipline of caste studies, if there is such a thing, of course, it ranges across various subdisciplines within social sciences and humanities, is also fundamentally constituted by a framework which comes out of the Christian backdrop of Europe and its approach to the study of India. And this is one of the things that we try to tackle in the book in various ways. And the title is, of course, a giveaway because it basically tells you that the foundations of the caste system are Western.
So it's obviously both a telling and nevertheless a provocative title. And so why don't you, I'm sure many, if not all of our listeners will have heard of the caste system and may have some notions of the caste system that says seems to be as pervasive as it has been problematic in terms of our understanding of it. Why don't you say a little bit about, okay, well, what is the caste system? And then what is the, we'll obviously drill down into it deeper, but what is the main thrust, position, theme of the book regarding caste system?
Yes. So first of all, I suppose we have to conjure up what kind of image the caste system, or we have to sort of just kind of outline what kind of image the idea of the caste system conjures up in popular and also academic imagination. And that goes something as follows. It is a kind of an oppressive structure which is specific to India, or sometimes some scholars would say more broadly South Asia. And it is a pan-Indian or South Asian phenomenon, a structure. It's others would say, well, of course, there is a hierarchical dimension of it, which lends a certain amount of specificity to the kind of oppressive structure it is. So that's a basic image we have of the caste system. And some other people would add on things such as, you know, it's characterized by endogamy and it has a fundamental root in the religion of Hinduism, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the basic kind of idea that we have of it. Now, our argument based on the research program of S.N. Balagangadhar is that the caste system is an entity in experience or an experiential entity which is specific to the European experience of India. So we say that in social reality, there is no such thing as caste system. The caste system exists as an entity which is experienced as Europeans have gone about in India and given shape to their experience of India.
So are you, just to clarify, are you arguing in this book that the caste system does not exist in and of itself and it's entirely a function of the perspective of scholars?
Yes, that's what we argue. Yeah. So when we say construction of the caste system, of course, there's a little bit of ambiguity which needs to be clarified because there are scholars, you know, there's a leading scholar of caste, Nicholas Dirks in California. He has argued that, well, actually, if you look at the patterns of social organization in India, as he studied it, in the past, in the pre-colonial past, you will see a diversity of forms of social structures and, you know, terminologies. And it's impossible to say that there was a kind of unified caste system in India. But then he goes on to say that as a consequence of the machinations of the colonial state, the British colonial state in India, although there existed no caste system prior to colonial intervention, after colonial intervention, or during and after colonial intervention, a caste system actually came into place. Now, that's a version of a constructionist argument, right? Because that would have us believe that the agency of the colonial state was such as to be able to institute a form of social organization which hadn't been present earlier in India. We don't take that perspective. We say that construction, as we use it, is construction at the ideational level. So the construction takes place at the level of giving shape to, as I said, the experience of people from a particular culture and their experience of another culture and society. So it exists only, if you like, pretty much as we argue Hinduism exists in Western universities, but there is no sort of existential equivalent of that in social reality.
So when we have, for example, and I'm not taking a position, obviously, in this interview, my role, my goal is simply just to drill down and derive an understanding of this work in hopefully an interesting way to our listeners. But here's a question. So when we encounter various references throughout various epochs of Hinduism to words such as Varna or Jati, or these what we think of forecasts of the Brahmana, the priestly scholars, the Kshatriya, the warrior administrators, the Vaishyas, the merchants and artisans, and the Shudras, those who serve the rest. When we encounter these references, then, in the Sanskrit literature itself, how would you reconcile that with your position?
Of course, we can't deny that these terms exist in the vast literature, the vast literary corpus of the India of the past. Those terms are there. Then I suppose we have to move to the problem of what do they mean, right? What does Varna mean? What does Jati mean? If you look at a term like Jati, actually, and we say so in the book, we say that what Jati stands for is actually a very difficult question to answer. But what has happened in the period since the colonial times in particular is that Jati seems to have been read as a constituent element of what the British and other Europeans described as the caste system of India. And we say that actually is a manifestation of a certain tendency that has taken root, particularly again since the colonial period, but it goes further back than that, where elements that don't necessarily belong in a single structure in the life of India have been brought together by a certain exercise of, if you like, construction or restructuring in the imagination of Europe and the West more broadly. So Jati becomes a component of the caste system only by putting it into a larger structure, you know, which has the kind of characteristics that I mentioned earlier, sort of oppression, hierarchy, endogamy. Many would say it's also an outcome of the Hindu religion, etc., etc. So so one of the fundamental problems is that how does that construction occur? How did that construction occur? And so we have various authors in the book actually trying to unpack that for us and to show us that the way in which these things were put together, including the ideas of Jati and Varna, are themselves a function of questions that Europe asked, given its own Christian background.
All right. So before we dig into the specific chapters and their contributions, just to clarify for our listeners that you take the position that caste itself as we know it, a social organizing hierarchy that most probably have a dimension of privilege and or oppression, that system wasn't walking on the ground in India, so to speak, but that system is a construct of Europe's understanding of India, correct?
Yes, because we haven't, for the last 200 or so years since the caste system has been spoken of, nobody has shown how a system such as the caste system could come about, right? And these were actually live questions. In the middle of the 19th century, these were live questions. And there were discussions in British journals during that time when people would say, well, how is it possible that the putative priestly class made up of Brahmins could institute a pan-Indian system in an age where obviously modern, you know, the kind of communications and transport that we have today did not exist. A centralized state authority did not exist, and so on and so forth. So nobody has really, you see, those questions about how such a system, putative system, could have come into place have simply gone into the background. Nobody has answered them, but at the same time, the figure of the caste system seems to have taken the level of a kind of presuppositional idea, the existence of which does not seem to need establishing or proving or evidencing, but it exists at the level of presupposition, or if you want to use a different term, at a pre-theoretical level. So all theory making about India and caste presupposes the existence of the caste system today. But we've never proved it. We've never empirically shown that here is a system which, you know, which takes the shape for which various contentions are made that belong to it.
Okay, so this obviously is fascinating and quite provocative in that I think it's fair to say the vast majority of even scholars on India would regard the caste system as perhaps fraught with misrepresentation, misunderstanding, and needing nuance, but nevertheless an entity on the ground. But as I say, it's not my role to take a position. It's my role to ask some interesting questions and get at the heart of what the position of the work is. But before going to the specific chapters, I have one question that I'd be interested to understand how you square away. If, say you have notions of various groups who don't eat with each other, for example, because of reasons of purity and pollution, that we would typically ascribe to being a function of caste system, that sort of behavior, how might you square that away?
I'm sorry, your final part of your question was how much?
How might you square away the fact that, for example, some groups would not eat with other groups because of this idea of lesser than or purity and pollution? Where would that fit into your understanding of caste as being a pure construct?
Yes. Well, that's a good question, an inevitable one, and in fact connects with your earlier mention of the large consensus that exists in the study of India about the existence of the caste system. I think you're completely right, actually, if we take the question from that end, that most scholars would be shocked to learn that a group of fellow scholars or a small group of fellow scholars is trying to say that, well, no such thing has ever existed, right? So its existence has never been proved.
And that's precisely why this is such a great book for this interview. But please proceed.
Yeah, sure. So it's, hence the sort of relevance of your question. So one of the things that we would say is that, you know, for any number of reasons, but let's say purity and pollution reasons, that people may not sit down together and eat with each other. Let's even bring in various other indices which are taken to be manifestations of the caste system, some kind of oppression between groups, some kind of conflict between groups, some kind of violent activities or incidents, etc., etc. You know, you can take any number of these things and say, well, surely aren't they manifestations? Aren't they evidences for the existence of the caste system? Well, see, my answer to that would be more or less exactly the same as what I said for the problem of jati. The fact that something like jati exists does not a caste system make. The fact that maybe, let's say, food taboos or rules about commensality and so on may exist in a society does not a caste system make, right? So what you need is some kind of unifying entity at a presuppositional level to bring all these things together and make them testify to the existence of a caste system. But the problem here is that we're working in reverse. What we have is the figment of the caste system first, which then unifies our experience of all of these things. And the fundamental question for us is, where does that notion of the caste system emerge from? Right? Where does it come from? What is its origin? That's the real problem that we need to really tackle in order to understand why is it that we've gone along for the last 200 years arguing in this particular way. That what we've done, you know, in there's this Latin phrase, petitio principi. So what we say is that what has to be proven has actually been presupposed. You know, and we've gone along in that way for the last 200 years.
And so regarding your question, regarding your question of origins, Unless you think there's another chapter you'd like to start digging into. Take, for example, chapter 7 on the Aryans and the ancient caste systems, the ancient system of caste. How about this notion of the caste system just being integral to Aryan culture of the ancient Vedic people, evidenced, for example, in the Purusha Sukta, the great hymn where the primordial person was sacrificed and various parts of him became various castes. His head represented the Brahmanas, his arms were the warriors, the Kshatriyas, his thighs were the Vaishyas, and his feet the Shudras, the servant class. So, for example, do you want to, in terms of origins, do you want to dig into that article perhaps?
Yeah, sure. Well, you have various sub-questions within that larger question. So we can talk about the problem of the Aryan presence or, you know, the putative either invasion or migration, depending on the preference of a particular scholar. So now that chapter by Marian Kappens is actually extremely fascinating. I mean, for me, it was a real eye-opener as well. Because she argues, doesn't she, that for the Aryan invasion theory to make sense, you need the trope of the caste system in place, right? She more or less argues that, or that they run concurrently, that they don't, one doesn't make sense without the other. And of course, there's a big debate currently about whether or not there was an Aryan invasion and so on. But she gives a very important, I think, inflection to that debate, because what she says is that, first of all, the presupposition about the existence of an Indian caste system or a Hindu caste system was already there in the scholarship. Now, along the way, of course, you had this thing about the peopling of the world, the biblical story about the peopling of the world and so on. So the two get intertwined. And then for India and India's population, because we have the caste system story in place already, there are various speculations by Orientalist scholars about how the peopling of India would have been done. And given that the caste system had to be explained as well, it took the following shape, that the Aryans were an alien people who came to India, dominated the pre-existing sets or groups of people, and of course they're variously described, and this is what actually lies at the base of the caste system as we think we know it, right? As we've described it already, or as previous scholars have described it. So the Aryan invasion theory actually becomes an adjunct to the caste system story and supports the caste system story. Now, Marian Kappens actually does more than that. What she does is say, well, actually, the concern among, let's say, anti-caste scholars of today, or even critical scholars, anti-caste activists or critical scholars of today, is not only with, or not specifically with, the ranking in the so assumed descendants of the Aryans, right? So the three higher orders, which they were supposed to have brought with them in their invasion enterprise, right? When they came to India. The concern is rather with the groups of people who were pre-existing, who were already existing in the Indian territory, and they are the ones who, if you like, were the most oppressed. And so the anti-caste activists and critical scholars actually take a position which sees that as the main cleavage, right? And so today, of course, we have great concern about untouchables or Dalits, as we call them, so on and so forth, scheduled castes, scheduled tribes in the contemporary legal parlance. And all of those are supposed to be, if you like, descendants of the originally occupied or invaded people. And so, in a way, what she does, what Marian Kappens does, is to explain how it is that caste studies and India studies has had a particular preoccupation with these people right at the bottom of the ladder, if you like, right? Or the scale, or the hierarchical scale. And what she does, very interestingly, is manage to show how the Aryan invasion theory manages to be an adjunct to the caste system story and provides an explanation for why we think the way we do about caste oppression and the groups which are most exposed to caste oppression. And what's interesting is that that story, in order to make sense of how we think about it today, we have to go back to the the Orientalist background. And that's really interesting. And the Orientalist background is actually consists merely of speculation. It's no more than that. There's no empirical work done by the Orientalists to show that there was an Aryan invasion. It's entire speculation, which today has assumed the status of fact in social science theory making about India. So it's tremendous. And actually, one can say that not just for the Aryan invasion part of the caste system story, one can say that for virtually any angle that you take with respect to the study of caste.
So regarding the Aryan invasion theory, you must have come across the recanting of that theory and the putting forth of the Aryan migration theory. Have you come across this, or does this factor into your thinking on caste?
Yes, I can't say I've done any particular work on it, but if one reads Marion Kaplan's chapter, she actually talks about the if you like, the more nuanced version of the invasion theory, which is the sort of gradual
migration
in various stages of groups of people from outside India into India. So that becomes a kind of soft version, if you like, of the of the Aryan incursion theories. But its effect is the same. I mean, so it's simply a modulation and a way of mitigating, if you like, the worst pitfalls of the invasion theorists, and to introduce a kind of softer one. But the effect is much the same for with respect to our concern with the caste system, I think.
All right, so let's take a look at one of the other six articles. We can do them really in any order, but while we're talking about ancient India, how about Martin Farek's article on Shramanas and Bhakti movement?
Yes, another fascinating chapter. That article has various dimensions to it as well, various layers to it. But I think we can say that Martin Farek's, one of his main concerns is to point out that there is a kind of unifying anti-caste hypothesis which characterizes our general understanding of all non-Hindu movements, or many non-Hindu movements, right down from Buddhism, Jainism, right up to the so-called Bhakti movements, right? And they're all viewed in the general literature as anti-caste movements and having a kind of egalitarian ethos and ethical basis. And he critiques that. He says that, well, actually, if you look at the writing, the contemporaneous writing, which, let's say, the Buddhists produce, or more recently the Bhakti, the actors within the Bhakti tradition have produced, you don't find an anti-caste or an egalitarian emphasis or ethos. What you find, in fact, is that these, let's call them schools or traditions, produce their own elucidations of, let's say, the question, what does it mean to be a Brahmin, right? So they don't discard or reject the idea of Brahmins because they are supposed to be representing, if you like, the top of a kind of oppressive caste structure. Right? Rather, what they do is take a hand in reformulating or reconstituting, in theoretical terms, what it takes to be a Brahmin, right? Which is still considered to be a kind of category or position, which is a kind of, you know, a kind of exemplary actor within society, or a position within society.
So what you would say, or rather what Martin Fourcq would be saying, is that the ancient Shramana, the renouncer movements, these ancient renouncers were more critiquing the specific function and duties of the Brahmins versus a hegemonic hierarchy in which the Brahmins were ensconced.
As Martin Fourcq has it, it's actually difficult to even go that far, because it's difficult to know what specific practices that were being performed by contemporaneous Brahmins were the objects of critique. It's pretty difficult to know. But what seems to be clearer is that there are certain preconditions. The discussion seems to be revolve very much around what does it take to be a Brahmin? What makes a Brahmin, right? So if you like, the discussion centers on the essential qualities of what a Brahmin is or who a Brahmin is. And various actors, thinkers of the time, the intellectuals of the time, are actually engaging in some kind of debate on that question, right? Rather than rejecting the position or post of a Brahmin. Of course, it begs the question, you know, how is Brahminhood to be understood, you know, in the past of India? And that's a huge question, actually. So partly, actually, Martin Fourcq makes a quite interesting contribution to that larger debate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of how the Indian traditions have conceptualized of what Brahminhood consists of.
Right, which is obviously an ongoing question.
Mm.
There is this, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it is from some of the descriptions of Ashoka regarding the distinction between Shramana and Brahmana, that they are opposed and they're sort of like a cat and dog. They're opposed, they contrast each other. And so the question then becomes, the question then becomes in your context, is that because of a rejection or an ascription to a caste system, or is that just in the redefinition of the Brahmana through the form of the Shramana? So that's obviously an interesting position. How about, I mean, we can look at them in any order, but how about we take a look at this also equally, if not more so, fascinating article about the Jews and the immorality of the caste system?
Yes, Jacob de Ruwe's chapter, yes.
Correct.
Jacob de Ruwe has, prior to writing this chapter, had already done very interesting work about how the Reformation polemic by the Protestants of the Catholic Church fed into the formulation of the idea of the caste system in India, right? So by the middle of the 19th century, you had quite a solidly formulated idea of the Indian or Hindu caste system. But Jacob de Ruwe had argued that one of the things it took to make that kind of formulation is the background of the Reformation debates that were already going on in Europe for a number of centuries by then, right? So, for example, the corrupt priesthood trope, right? The corrupt priesthood trope is one that was initially leveled by Protestants against the Catholic Church, right? It was, in fact, the basis of the whole Reformation argument against the Church. And it's this kind of polemic which then gets transplanted into India and provides a way of Europeans understanding their experience of India and the various groups that they were encountering. So the Brahmins then, you know, quite naturally seem to assume the role of priests, right? But the notion of the priest is actually completely absent in India. It's actually a European Christian notion, which then gets read into India
as a way of Europeans trying to grapple with their experience of, you know, what they were seeing in India, and so on and so forth. So they were not only priests, but they were priests who pervade certain false doctrines as if they were true doctrines, and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting about the chapter that Jacob de Ruwer writes in this book is that he expands the discussion to Jews and the position that Jews acquired in post-Reformation European writing. And one of the things he helps us to do is also understand some of the very specific dimensions which have been attributed to the caste system in India, actually derive not necessarily from the Protestant polemic against the Catholic Church in Europe, but against the Protestant polemic of Jews and Judaism. That's a fundamental contribution, I think. And so ideas like a priestly tribe, which the Brahmins came to be, was actually an analog of the priestly tribes among Jews. Notions of purity and pollution, which they were supposed to uphold, which the Jews, the priestly class was supposed to uphold, actually, well, you know, you yourself mentioned the ideas of purity and pollution. I think it's worth pursuing the question: to what extent do they depend on discussions that were already going on in Europe and were then transplanted into a reading of the caste system, and not just the reading of the caste system, in fact, for the formulation of the caste system in India. We also have ideas of excommunication, right? And so on and so forth. So there's a number of tropes which get generated in Protestant or post-Reformation Europe against Jews and Judaism, which are then used to, if you like, go into the larger mix in the formulation of the notion of the caste system in India. You know, so one of the things that, in fact, all these chapters are doing, Marion Kaplan's chapter, Martin Farek's chapter, and Jacob de Ruwer's chapter, is they flesh out in particular ways how different components of what we see as integral to the caste system today are actually a function of earlier Christian and Orientalist formulations, and how they then go into the reading of what was going on in India, you know, by Europeans. And that's right. Really fascinating.
Right, and that's more or less why I sort of began with those three in terms of them being the historical foundation of your thesis. So before you move on to the other specifically, earlier you had described it, and also obviously in the book you describe it as the Western foundations being Christian. Would you say that primarily is based on Jacob de Ruwer's chapter with these polemics against Catholic priests and Jews, or is there another article that brings that to the fore?
I think you see it throughout, actually, particularly in the chapters, the three chapters that we've discussed so far, right? So if you look at the idea of the peopling of the world, right, the biblical story of the peopling of the world, Marian Kaplan shows how that becomes so relevant to understanding the role that the Aryan invasion thesis then later on plays, if you like, yeah? Because you need to have some kind of explanation of how India was peopled. Martin Farek's stuff is also relevant to this because in a part that we didn't yet discuss, which is the notion of endogamy and how one particular line of inquiry which he tries to introduce is that the notion of endogamy actually may potentially be traceable back to concerns about endogamy which were prevalent in Iberia, in the Iberian Peninsula, and fundamental to Catholic thought in its suspicion of whether or not converted populations had really converted and how far back you needed to go to be considered to be truly Christian. And some of that polemic or some of that discussion was actually transplanted into the Iberian colonization project and was potentially also used to read data that the Europeans encountered in India. And so that's, you can see how that would, you know, also have a kind of very, a base in Christian thinking about a fundamental component of what's assumed to be today the caste system. And of course, Jacob de Rouve's paper we discussed about the post-Reformation polemic. So in various ways, the backdrop of Christianity is actually fundamental because, in fact, in the larger research program, what we argue is that Christianity is constitutive of the Western culture. Right? And so the whole dynamic of Western culture as a religious culture is dependent on Christianity. And so these are just various strands that go into fleshing out the, you know, particular aspects of what Europe has done in order to, you know, sort of give structure to its own experience of India.
I imagine that you would find little argument among scholars relating regarding Christianity being constitutive of Western thought. Even in a secular world.
No, the argument is it's constitutive of Western culture, not just Western thought.
Western culture.
No, what yeah, as a culture.
Yes. And so I imagine that there would be much, there would be agreement on that point. The question of whether or not that culture ended up authoring, constructing a caste system is obviously the more intriguing and controversial position of the book. We've looked at some of these ancient elements, such as the polemic against Catholics and Catholic priests and Jews, such as the Sherman and the Bhakti movement and the Aryan migration culture. Let's look at some of the more contemporary modern stuff. Do you want to maybe start with your article or another?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we can do a broad brush and across all of the three remaining chapters.
Sure.
So what we have is a chapter by S.M. Balagangadhar, who is also the founder of the research program. And he, in his particular chapter in this book, enters into a very interesting dimension of how social justice concerns appear to be at the forefront of contemporary arguments as to why the caste reservation system was introduced in post-independence India, right? And what he does, one of the things he does is go back to the Constituent Assembly debates to show how the individual proponents of reservations had tried to justify it. And one of the things he shows is that, of course, the proponents of the reservation system were not themselves, or not primarily themselves, Christian, right? So they were not themselves coming out of Christian backgrounds. So the reason why that is important to note or announce is that, and this is something that Balagangadhar also shows, is that social justice comes about as an outcome of Catholic social doctrine, which has been elaborated since the middle of the 19th century, right? So our contemporary secularized ideas of social justice actually find their root also in Christian theological thinking, and in particular, the Catholic social doctrine. And so to connect the two parts of the argument, the fact that a leading spokespersons in the Indian Constituent Assembly who argued for reservations could not have had access to Christian ideas themselves shows that the claim that reservations are based on some kind of normative idea of social justice must be hollow, right? Although there are, you know, it's been claimed quite widely in contemporary writing and thinking. Okay, moving on to the next chapter, which is by my colleagues Sufia Pathan and Duncan Jalki, who are working away in India, in Karnataka. And this is, I would argue, this is a very fundamental chapter, right? Because one of the things they do is that they show to us that the claim that the so-called lower castes or scheduled castes in India suffer disproportionately from acts of violence or atrocities cannot be substantiated if one looks at the only set of available statistics there are in India, which is the national crime statistics. And in fact, they show the reverse, that members of scheduled castes appear to experience a lower level of violence than the rest of the population. My chapter talks about a recent development in Britain, where there has been an attempt to institute a law on caste discrimination, or law against caste discrimination, as part of the Equality Act of 2010, and how there's been a kind of, I would say, a quite disingenuous attempt to insert such a provision and to ensure that it gets implemented. And one of the parallel tracks that attempt took was to institute a strategic litigation in the British courts, which I also argue is manifests the same kind of disingenuity that the attempt to insert the caste provision in the legislation does, because, I mean, for various reasons, it's possible to argue that at this stage. We can go into it more deeply in due course.
This is as good a time as any. We'll go a little more deeply into your article, and then it's the perfect opportunity to then zoom out and talk a little bit about your forward and your afterward and some larger questions. Why are these British lawmakers being disingenuous regarding these new laws against caste discrimination?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound too strong. I suppose what I would say is the advocates of the caste legislation and the case law on caste, I would say that they have been disingenuous to a certain degree, because if one looks at the evidential base, let's say the assertions that, you know, with the transplantation of an Indian or a South Asian diaspora in Britain, the caste system would have also been transplanted, and therefore, you know, consequence acts of discrimination and violence, atrocities and so on, we would also be able to witness them and so on, hasn't actually been proven. It's not as though studies have not been attempted. Now, the first set of studies which you'll find on the record are studies which have been produced by the activists or advocacy organizations themselves, so the Dalit organizations, which also have some kind of rooting in the British diaspora population. But if you look at their methodology, it's very often or almost always revolves around positing certain stories as though they constitute irrefutable evidence of caste discrimination, right? Without seeking alternative explanations, without seeking alternative accounts of how those same incidents or experiences could be explained, etc., etc. Then you have a set of official studies, which unfortunately also take the same route, right? And they've been guided by the activist organizations. So I would say that despite the attempt to provide the impression that caste discrimination has become prevalent with the transplantation of an Indian or South Asian diaspora in Britain, once you dig deeper into the methodological problems that the studies have used, you won't be able to say that there is empirical evidence for the presence of caste discrimination in Britain, right? Now, that hasn't stopped the legislators from initially saying that what we will do is to still have a provision on caste and make it an aspect of racial discrimination in the equality legislation, right? And so if you look at the legislative debates, you'll find some very strange things. Now, some legislators were saying things to the effect that, well, even if there is one case of caste discrimination, I would be prepared to legislate. If you look at all the other sort of grounds of equality in the legislation, you know, they've accumulated over the years, like gender, race, sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. They've always all been preceded by extensive studies, reports, research, and so on, which testify to the presence of discrimination, along the lines of those categories. So they've always been sort of very substantially proven or established problems before legislation took root. In the case of caste, the opposite has happened, right? That you've already got in by 2010 a provision, legislative provision, but the attempt to study it and to have official studies, officially sponsored study on the studies on the problem, take place after that, and even they don't manage to show that there is empirically irrefutable evidence that caste discrimination is present. In fact, the study that the government itself commissioned in 2010 shows that what we would need is a much larger research program to establish the prevalence of caste discrimination to any degree. It's the study itself says so, you know. And despite of that, the legislators went ahead and sort of not only advocated the insertion of a caste provision, but made it mandatory. In 2013, there was an amendment in the British Parliament which said that the minister must institute or must implement the provision on caste discrimination, right? And that was at a time knowing that the only official study had asked for a larger research program to investigate the problem. Right, they hadn't said that there's irrefutable evidence, and they hadn't, neither had they said that there are clear grounds for legislating on this issue. Now, if you move to the case, that's also interesting because that takes a kind of parallel track. The legislation not having been implemented, a test case was mounted. And one of the interesting things is that the litigant in the case, she was a household servant who had accompanied a family. Who, you know, originally from India. So she'd been engaged in India, worked with the family, and then the family moved to England. And so she came with them. She claims to be a Bihari Christian Adivasi woman, right? And no doubt she is. And the case starts off as a problem, as a case of underpayment. So there was a claim of underpayment of wages, etc. Right? Caste gets introduced later into the pleadings. And in fact, the whole case comes through the hierarchy of the court system because of the caste point, right? Because the point has to be litigated as a preliminary one, whether or not in the absence of an effected caste provision in the Equality Act, can we still say that caste claims can be brought under the existing provisions of the Equality Act? Now, the answer is in the affirmative. The courts give an affirmative yes and say that, well, given the existing provision on ethnicity, which already includes descent, we can read caste into it as well. So you've got no bar to bring caste discrimination claims under the legislation already. Now, the facts of the case are really interesting. One of the things you'll see as you read the various judgments, both from the Employment Tribunal and also the Employment Appeal Tribunal, which is at the level of the High Court in England, nobody asks the specific caste or tribal background of the litigant. But that's not interesting in itself. Nobody asks the caste background of the employers. Now, you'd have thought that if there was a claim of caste discrimination being made, you at the very least need to know the caste background of both the plaintiff and the defendants, but you don't get that anywhere, right? And one of my arguments has been that actually what's happened again, you know, what we talked about earlier with respect to how you need to have a caste system story in place before you can put unrelated aspects or facts together as if they testify to the presence of a caste system, or that the caste system comes to be an explanation for why those facts are the way they are. And so that's what you have in this case as well. That's basically my argument in the chapter. right? That you need to have the caste system story as a presupposition in order to find an explanation for why facts occur as they do. And right. Even when the facts don't fit together, the caste system story actually supplies the silent elements, if you like, right? The presuppositional elements. So despite a very weak evidential base, one might still say or read into a certain set of facts that they occurred as a result of caste discrimination, which is consequent to the caste system.
Definitely a fascinating article.
That's a very heavily summarized account without any full stops.
Not a problem. That's fascinating stuff. Let's end with a broader question that the year afterward is fairly well organized in terms of subheadings that the reader will naturally have as questions. And you go from, is there a caste system, onto, well, you know, why did the West see the caste system? I think we've more or less covered that. How about we end with this idea of, well, why do Indians buy into the story? Why do Indians see the caste system?
That is a brilliant question, if I may say so. Because it is true. If you ask the average Indian, you know, something like, well, don't you have a caste system in India today? Almost 100% of the responses you get would be in the affirmative, wouldn't you? And hence the importance of your question, particularly in light of the claims that we make in the book, right? If we say that there is no caste system, how comes all these Indians go around saying, well, of course, you know, we have a caste system, it's oppressive, it's hierarchical, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, within the confines of the research program, what we've been arguing through Bala Gangadhar's work is that there is a way in which a colonized culture like India, but it's not restricted to India, has taken on stories which Europeans have told about it and about the members of that culture as though they reflect the experiences of people within that culture, right? And we call that colonial consciousness. And colonial consciousness takes root because the kind of stories that Europeans have told since the colonial period have been forced through some kind of system of education. But because they are not cognitively convincing, right? They don't follow logical rules, et cetera, et cetera. So they defy the ordinary cognitive processes. We've needed an additional element, which is the element of violence. So that's one of the constituent elements of how, or the explanatory factors of how colonial consciousness gets spread through a culture or colonized culture. And so the caste system story and its widespread acceptance, we would say, is one of the facets of the ongoing colonial consciousness of the Indian population.
This is obviously a fascinating topic in terms of the presence of caste, the understandings of caste, and even caste in practice now, and the extent to which this ever was a pervasive Indian practice, and the extent to which it now is, and the reasons for current practice, whether they stem in a colonial consciousness or an ancient indigenous tradition. These are obviously very intriguing questions that point to the provocative nature of this work. It has been great pleasure and intrigue to actually speak to you about this work. For our listeners, once again, I've been speaking with Dr. Prakash Shah, who's a reader in culture and law at Queen Mary University of London in the United Kingdom. Prakash, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks very much for appearing on the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network.
Thank you very much yourself for taking the initiative and the time to have this conversation.
All right.
Yeah.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.